jeudi. On accueille pour notre colloquium Laura Benetton de l'Université de Toronto et l'équipe Cosmic Coincidences and Several Other Stories. Okay, thank you very much.
So, for my talk, I need the choice of generic stars in heavens. Heavens is S2 all around us. So come in. Sorry. And you can take copies of the handout as you go in. So heavens is S2 all around us. So let me start by posting copies, by putting some stars around, okay? Well, let's put one here. Okay, I think we have enough. Okay, so let me really start now. So, so in the beginning, I want to tell you some fun story about how to use these stars that I've just chosen in generic positions to construct a knot invariant. Here's a knot, and I'm going to construct an invariant for such things. And this will be completely basic and elementary, and I hope you will follow everything. Then, in the second half of the talk, I will describe and in more like sketch how that invariant that looks completely arbitrary from the first part is actually deeply related to lots of things. So, to Feynman diagrams, quantum field theory, configuration space integrals, how its target space, the space A, where it takes values, is somehow a space of universal formulas that make sense in any metrized Lie algebra, so in mostly finite dimensional Lie algebras, and how choosing specific Lie algebras corresponds to famous other knot invariants, the Jones polynomial, etc. And finally, I will tell you how this invariant solves a certain universal topological problem, and that in itself is solving a certain universal Lie algebraic problem. But that's the second half, and it will be very sketchy. And then in the remaining time, I will tell you that all of this is a subset of an even bigger story that has to do not just with knots, but also with two-dimensional knots in R4 and various other sort of. So that was the U story, usual knots, and there is also a W story and a V story about, and a P story perhaps, about other types of topological gadgets. So that's the plan. Okay? Now, where's my... good. Now, the key point, this picture, which is on your handout, is the absolute key point. And my real main purpose is that you'll understand this picture. So, kind of, if you follow and understand this picture, you can fall asleep after that, and you'll still gain something from this lecture. Okay? But then there is the rest, and the rest is in the handout, and I hope all of you have a copy. And finally, I should make a disclaimer. I mean, the real story is more complicated than how I will present it. And also, there are cracks in it somewhere, in some places. All of them at the end can be sort of circumvented. You can always go around the cracks and get the right answer. But I'll ignore all the cracks altogether and try to concentrate on the beauty. Can I start? Okay. So I guess I should start by explaining why the stars were planted in various places. So, first of all, I want to tell you about the signed Stonehenge pairing of a diagram D. Here is a diagram. It's a circle with some number of arcs, chords, so-called, well, edges, marked in it, also with trivalent vertices. And I'm going to tell you how to pair a diagram like this with a knot like that. So, the pairing goes as follows. Well, you just count with signs all the possible ways of placing this diagram on top of the knot, which really means that the circle in the diagram should correspond to the parameter space of the knot, and the edges of the diagram should correspond to chopsticks You know that sort of, you know what chopsticks are. I don't know if you know what chopsticks are, but you know, here are sort of chopstick-like objects, and I have plenty of them. Okay? I bought them yesterday at the Carrefour. Anyway, so that these chopsticks are pointing each one at a different star in heavens. So, you know, a typical example would be, here is the knot. You place it in some position in R3, and you count the ways of putting the chopstick so that one will be pointing at that star, another one will be pointing at that star, and I put all my stars at not sufficiently generic places, so let's make Emmanuel another star, and then another star is, another chopstick is pointing at Emmanuel. Now, let me be clear, the chopsticks are really lines, they are directed lines, right, they have a sharp end, but they are not of fixed size. So, this is also a legitimate placement. I mean, well, sorry. If I could place it so that each one of those would be placed pointing at a star, that would be a legitimate placement. So why Stonehenge pairing? Because, you know, there are all sorts of stories about if you stand in one corner of Stonehenge and look via the big stone on the other end at a certain specific date of the year, you see the morning star aligned with something else. So basically I'm counting cosmic coincidences that have to do with this specific embedding of a knot. Okay? Now, how many do I expect to see? So let's count equations and unknowns. So let's first do it unsophisticatedly, and then slightly more sophisticatedly. So unsophisticatedly, how many equations, how many unknowns do I have? Well, I need to know where to put the left end of this chopstick. Okay, and there is a one-parameter space of possibility, so this is one unknown. I need to know where to put this end, that's another unknown. I need to know where to put the last chopsticks, that's another unknown. Finally, I need to decide where to put the vertex in R3, that's three unknowns. So I have six unknowns. Now, also, each chopstick should be pointing at a star. Heavens, the space around us, is two-dimensional. Stars are points, so there are co-dimensions too in heavens. So to say that the chopstick, I've chosen finitely many stars, but to say that the chopstick is pointing straight at the star, like there or there, is two equations. So I have two equations from here, two equations from here, two equations from here. The number of equations is equal to the number of unknowns. And if that was generic, if everything was generic, I expect a finite number of solutions. Count these. And that would be the Stonehenge pairing. Where is it? Went away. Oh, here. Oh, no, that would be the Stonehenge pairing of this diagram with this knot. Okay? Here's a slightly more sophisticated way to say it. Really, I have a map from S1 cross S1 cross S1 cross R3. So, that point is in S1, that one is in S1, that one is in S1. This one is in, the last one is in R3. And I have a map to... Well, the direction to which this chopstick is pointing, it's a point in S2. So to S2 cross the direction to which this chopstick is pointing, another S2 cross another S2. So I have a map from one six-dimensional manifold to another six-dimensional manifold. And I'm counting the pre-images of some fixed points here. Some specific generic points here. Now, around any pre-image, the map going from here to here will either be locally orientation preserving or orientation reversing, and that's the signs. Okay, I'm not being specific, I'm not telling you how to orient the space. We have to decide, the decision to make, which orientation to pick. I'm just telling you it's easy to put signs, I'm not telling you how, it's a waste of your time at this point. Okay? Now, in fact, I could have generalized. The diagram didn't have to be this one. I could have been counting the Stonehenge pairing with this diagram. First of all, what would this mean? It would mean chopstick towers that look like, well, sort of like a... Sorry?
Right, that.
Okay? Where each of the chopstick is pointing at a star. At this point, they're not. Okay, but that would be the idea. Anyway, what would be the count here? So again, I have 1, 2, 3, 4 unknowns, plus 3 from here and 3 from here, that's a total of 10. How many equations? 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. That's again 10, and again I expect the finite count and I determine the signs in the same way. So, and you can verify that the same thing has an expected, a zero-dimensional space of solutions, meaning a countable, a thing that can be counted, whenever the diagram is a trivalent graph. And really it should be a trivalent graph with a distinguished circle, where the circle corresponds to the knot, and some interior part that corresponds to the chopsticks. Okay, so that's what I'm counting.
Where's my count?
Okay, now, you know, the earliest example of such a count is the so-called Gauss linking numbers. Number. So if you have a two-component link, so a two-component link, you just mean, I mean, take a one component and then have another component somehow go through it. The Gauss linking number of the two components, one way of describing it is you count the crossings between the two components with signs. So, for example, and in fact, you should only count the, you label the components, this is first, this is second, and you only count the crossings in which the second is over the first. Or maybe it's the other way around, I don't know, I mean, it really doesn't matter. So, for example, if it is this link, you'd be counting these two crossings, and the Gauss linking number of these two links, of this link, is 2. If it is this link, you'd be counting only this crossing, and its Gaussian linking number is 1. You can prove that the Gaussian linking number is an invariant, and the fact that it's 1 here and 2 here means that these two are not equivalent, something that you probably could have guessed anyway. Okay? Anyway, let's view it from the chopstick perspective. This is really... So I've generalized the chopstick story from having one circle to having two circles because I wanted to correspond with links, and there is only a single chopstick, and I may as well, the star could have been anywhere, you may as well think that it's your eye. And then a chopstick pointing at your eye is just a dot. You only see it as a vertical dot. You only see sort of a point. So counting chopsticks going from this component to that component and pointing at your eye is exactly pointing, counting crossings with signs. And that's the Stonehenge pairing of these two, and it's the Gaussian linking number. Now that seemed good, I hope. So if something is good, we try to look at everything of that kind. So we make a generating function. So the generating function of all cosmic coincidences, let's call it Z of K, and it's an invariant of a knot, or sorry, it's a quantity associated with a knot K, or in fact with a specific embedding of a knot K, and a specific choice of stars in heavens. And the interesting part of this quantity is in blue. So therefore I'll start with the red. But sorry, with the black. Combinatorial factors that you don't want to ever think about. And take the limit as n goes to infinity, n is the number of stars. So take a large number of stars, and in fact it stabilizes. So all you want is the number of stars to be bigger than the number of edges in your diagram. Okay? And then, now let's do the interesting, and then there is some counter term. Again, I don't want to talk about it. So the interesting part is, you count over all trivalent diagrams D, the Stonehenge pairing of D with the knot times the diagram. So this lives in some space A, with, well really it's A of a circle, okay? And the space A is the space of formal linear combinations of diagrams. So, you know, Z of a knot K could have been something like Z of a knot K could have been something like 7, but there are the coefficients, so 7 times, I don't know what, 23 factorials and things, times this diagram, plus 22 times that diagram, minus 11 times this diagram, and so on. So it's a formal linear combination of diagrams. In fact, an infinite formal linear combinations with diagrams that have increasing complexity, more and more complexity. And the coefficient of each diagram, if you ignore the combinatorics, is just its Stonehenge pairing with the with our knot. Okay. Now, is this a knot invariant? It would be lovely if it is. If it would be a knot invariant, namely, it would be lovely if it would turn out that it's independent on the of the specific embedding of the knot in R3 and the placement of the chopsticks. Sorry, the placement of the stars. Okay. I already talked for 3 hours today, so if I'm confused, I have a good excuse. Anyway, it isn't an invariant. But what I will do in a minute is I will analyze how it changes when you deform the knot. And it will turn out that when you deform the knot, most of the time, nothing happens. But occasionally, well, this is like counting the solutions of a system of equations that depends on a parameter. If you move the parameter just a little bit, the solutions will move move a little bit, but the count will not change. But occasionally there will be a catastrophe, and two solutions will get added. But I'm counting with signs, so it doesn't matter. And then occasionally, there will be some other type of catastrophe, and it will turn out that those other types of catastrophes, and I'm going to describe them in a minute, always involve the change in count for three diagrams at the same time. So maybe for this diagram and that diagram and that diagram, the change in counts of this diagram and that diagram and that diagram will change at exactly the same time. So therefore, if I mod out by the relation this plus this plus this is equal to zero, so I look at the quotient of the space formally generated by diagrams, in which I set this plus this plus this to be zero, or more precisely, with signs. So the signs are written here. Then, in the quotient, I will get an invariant. That's the plan. Okay. So, let's think some more. Okay, the first thing that might happen is the following. So, suppose a part of the knot is on the plane of the table. Okay? Suppose a part of the knot is in the plane of the table. And suppose there is a star right over there. So, a chopstick could be have one end on the plane of the table, and then its other end will be on the star over there. So as the chopstick, as the one end of the chopstick moves along the knot, sort of the chopstick itself spans a plane, the desk. In fact, things could be curved, so it will not be a plane, but a surface, but locally it's a plane. Okay? And now suppose I have another part of the knot, and that other part of the knot dips into this plane. So before it dips into this plane, I have no count. After it dips into this plane, all of a sudden I have a count of two. But it's two with opposite signs, and they cancel. Okay? So this is the first case, and nothing bad happens. Essentially, I told you that, you know, if you count the solutions of this equation or the solutions of this equation, the count is the same, if you count with signs. Okay, so let's move on and talk about something more interesting. And as I said, this is the one thing that I want you to really follow. Okay, and it's really, really complicated, but it's also very, very basic. So let me describe the situation. Okay, I have a knot. In fact, the knot is very much like this one. Okay, so here is the knotted part of it, and the knottedness actually plays no role, so I just made the rest of the knot be uninteresting. But okay, now I have a green star somewhere up there. You see, in fact, there is. You see the green star, it's way up there, okay? And if I have a chopstick pointing at the green star and starting from somewhere around this piece of this knot, it will span a plane, again, not a plane, a curved plane, a surface, but still, the possibilities will span a plane, roughly a plane. Likewise, I have a purple star down there, oops, it fell. In fact, it's good that it fell. It fell right to where it should be. So I have a purple star down there, and the possible chopsticks pointing at it span this plane. And I have a blue star down there. Well, you don't see it, but it's there. And the chopsticks starting from the top edge and going to it span the blue plane. And let me think that all of these stars are a bit off, just for visualization, are a bit off the plane of the blackboard. In fact, they're all behind the plane of the blackboard. So all of these planes are sloped down. So I get sort of a valley. In the middle, and in the middle of the valley, the three planes meet, and at the point O, and the point O, in fact, corresponds to a contribution to the cosmic count of a diagram that has one green, one purple, one blue chopstick. Again, the colors don't mean anything. I'm just trying to identify which chopstick is pointing at which star. Anyway, the point O corresponds to a contribution to this to the Stonehenge pairing of this diagram with our knot. Okay? Now, suppose there is a fourth star, and it's the golden star, the orange star, and it's up there. Okay? And the chopsticks starting here are pointing at it and are creating a plane, and the golden star is precisely at the plane of the blackboard. So the golden plane is just a flat, sort of flat on the blackboard, and then it sort of, when you look from your direction, what you see is sort of a golden lake in the middle of this valley. Okay, this is this golden triangle. Is it clear what the picture is? Okay? And now suppose I start deforming things. Okay? So suppose I deform, maybe I push the golden star back.
Or alternatively, I push this part of line, of arc segment back. Or maybe I push the purple star up. The easiest way to view it, the easiest way to visualize what happens is to think about pushing the golden star plane back. So this yellow triangle goes further and further back and becomes smaller and smaller and smaller until it goes through this point, and then it reappears on the other side where there is sort of an inverse cup. Okay? That is the catastrophe, where the golden plane goes through the point, goes to the other side of the point O. What happens to the Stonehenge count of this diagram at that time? You know, if there is a handout, then there should also be questions and then homework assignment. So what happens to the Stonehenge count of this diagram when I go through the critical point, the catastrophe? Answer, nothing. Because it doesn't even see the point O, it doesn't even see the orange star. This diagram doesn't even, nothing is pointing at the orange star. Who cares? So the catastrophe is actually a little more complicated. So suppose there was a fifth star. And the fifth star is your eye. So chopsticks pointing at the fifth star look like dots, like red dots. Okay? So here is an example of an interesting thing you can do with a red dot. Consider the line in which purple and blue meet. This is this line here. It starts over there, but it continues behind the green plane. Okay? And at some point it passes exactly behind the line in which orange and green meet. This is this line here. And at that place, you could put a vertical chopstick, which would be pointing from this line, so from the purple-blue line, to the green-orange line. Okay? And that would be a contribution to the cosmic count of this diagram. Because, you see, you have a purple chopstick. I suppose it would be this one. Pointing at behind the point I. And a blue chopstick, I cannot point, but pointing to behind the point I. And they meet at a red chopstick, which is vertical. And it goes to the connection of to the place where green and orange, where an orange chopstick and a green chopstick can be placed. So that would be a contribution to this diagram. Are you with me? Okay. Now I push the orange plane back, and this configuration disappears when I'm behind. In fact, it doesn't disappear. It just reappears sort of mirrored, and you can count the signs and find that it reappears with a different sign. But fortunately, at exactly the same time, when the orange plane goes behind, the sign of H flips and the sign of X flips. Well, H is really this diagram that looks like the letter H, and the color coding says everything. And X is this diagram that looks like the letter X, and again, the color coding says everything. So, are you with me? So, at exactly the same time, at exactly the time of the catastrophe, the signs of these three diagrams will switch, will flip. Now, this is the simplest occurrence of this catastrophe. Really, it could have been much more complicated, because I could have been looking at a way more complicated diagram. I think I had a simple complicated diagram before, maybe, you know, that one. Okay? But I mean, if I were to count something pertaining to that diagram, it would be generally the same principle. So I would be creating a plane for one chopstick and another plane for another chopstick, and then perhaps out of the intersection line of these planes, there would be another chopstick emanating, and out of the intersection line of and that will in itself create a plane, really surface. And then that surface will intersect with yet another surface coming from another direction, and there will be another intersection line, and another chopstick will be starting there. And when I'll start moving the knots or the stars, this whole great gadget will move around, and nothing will change until there is a catastrophe, and the catastrophe will be of that type. Maybe the orange plane will not be... maybe these planes will be all sort of way deeper inside the structure, but the catastrophe locally will have the same nature. So therefore, if I mod out by the IHX relation, which says that in this space of formal linear combinations of diagrams, if you see an I picture anywhere, or the same diagram with an H picture in it, or the same diagram with an X picture in it, then the sum of the three is equal to zero, again with signs. So if I mod out by this relation, this catastrophe doesn't bother me anymore. Are you with me? Now you can fall asleep. Okay, there is another catastrophe that could happen, and the other catastrophe is the following. So, how should I say that? So I have these planes, and I have the intersection line of two of these planes. So I guess this is the intersection line of two of these planes. This intersection line in itself could, instead of cutting through another intersection line, which is what the previous catastrophe was, it could cut through the knot itself. And again, you can analyze what happens locally, and I will not repeat the analysis. It's more or less the same analysis, only simpler. And it turns out that you will have a contribution to this diagram, where this is a piece of the circle around the diagram. And you'll have a contribution for this diagram and a contribution for this diagram, and they will flip signs at the same time. So if you mod out by the so-called STU relation, which says that S is equal to T minus U, you're okay. No changes happen. And then, let me lie, everything works. The truth is that there is yet another catastrophe that can happen, and the yet another catastrophe is more or less the following. So you see, there is also a tangent line to the knot. The tangent line describes a curve in heavens, right? I'm always pointing at a point in heavens. So the knot is also a curve in heavens. Now I move that curve, and that curve may, you know, as I move it, it may cross over a star. Okay? That's another catastrophe, and the way to fix it is to multiply it by some frame-independent counter term, whatever that means. I don't want to talk about it. I have other things to say. Forgive me. The theorem is that once you've modded out by these relations, this generating function of cosmic coincidences is a knot invariant, and that's the end of chapter one of my talk. Can I go on? Okay. Oh, so who cares about this? First of all, possibly, you know, when I mod out by these relations, it's conceivable that I'm left with nothing. Maybe there is nothing that remains of this space. So maybe the space of formal linear combinations of diagrams modulo these combinatorial relations is the zero vector space, and therefore I found a sophisticated way of constructing the trivial invariant, the constant. Okay? It isn't. That's not the case. So indeed, if you look at these relations more carefully, they kind of scream at you. We're about Lie algebras. Why? So basically you want to interpret the purple vertex as a bracket, and you want to interpret the black line as let us multiply in an associative algebra. So what is written here is let us multiply the bracket of x and y. Sorry, multiply a single thing, sorry. So it's just the bracket of x and y. On the other hand, this is let us multiply x with y, and this is let us multiply, well, first y and then x. So the STU relation sort of reads x bracket y is equal to xy minus yx, which is well known from Lie algebras. The IHX relation, so now let me read it slightly differently. So again, the purple vertex means bracket. So this can, so, and let me label the ends x, y, z, and output. So if I look from the output into this structure, then on the right I see a z, and on the left I see the bracket of x and y, so I see the bracket of x and y with z. Likewise, if I interpret this one, I'll see the bracket of x with y and z, and, well, I will not read out this one, but the total thing is the Jacobi identity. So it screams Lie algebra. Now, this is sort of just very sort of impressionistic. I don't know. I mean, it's not mathematics. It screams Lie algebras, but it doesn't scream how. So now let's be more precise. And the precise thing is let G be a finite dimensional Lie algebra and with a metric. So with an invariant non-degenerate symmetric inner product. Typical example is a semi-simple Lie algebra with its Killing form. Okay, but there are a few other examples as well. But in particular, all the classical Lie algebras are examples. So SLN, SUN, SON, SPN, G2, E8, all of these are examples. Pick an orthonormal basis with respect to the inner product. Actually, I could do without, but this is the fewest words, okay? Take a representation with base, finite dimensional representation with basis V alpha, and I can construct the structure constants of the Lie algebra. So the structure constants are, so they depend on three indices which run from 1 to the dimension of the Lie algebra. So these are indices in the lowercase Latin alphabet. Okay, like this index here. And FABC is defined to be the bracket of XA with XB, inner product with XC, and please forgive me for dropping the X's here, it's a typo. Okay? Likewise, there is the matrix entries of the representation, which is again a tensor with three indices. Namely, if you compute x alpha acting on v beta, where v beta is one of the generators here, and xa is one of the basis elements of the Lie algebra, then it's a linear combination of v gammas, and let the coefficients be called r beta alpha a gamma. Okay? And now, suppose I have a diagram of the type that I had before. What I do is I label the chopsticks, or rather the internal edges, with lowercase English letters, sorry, Latin letters, French letters, A, B, C, and I label the external edges, alpha, beta, gamma, and then I think of this, each of these as a copy of the structure constants with subscripts according to the English letters around, French letters around it. And I think of each of these as an instance of the matrix entries of the representation, again with letters as around it. So this thing becomes a sum of one copy of the structure constants and three copies of the representation tensor. So, I mean, for example, here you'll have an RA beta gamma. Here you'll have an RB gamma alpha. RB gamma alpha appears here. Okay? So this is a certain algebraic expression. And sum it over all possible choices of A, B, and C running from 1 to the dimension of the Lie algebra, and alpha, beta, gamma running from 1 to the dimension of the representation. And the claim is that this ugly expression is independent of all the choices that were made. You have to verify it. Okay? Anyway, furthermore, you see the bracket, the vertex really does correspond to the bracket. It's the structure constants which come from the bracket. This vertex really does correspond to multiplying in a certain representation. And so it turns out that the functional that I have just defined on diagrams descends to the quotient by these relations, satisfies these relations. Okay? So the space in which my invariant takes values, this calligraphic A of before, has a linear functional on it for any choice of Lie algebra and representation. And it's very easy to compute it on a few examples and check that these linear functionals are not zero, and therefore that space is non-trivial, and at least we're relieved of the fear that our work was for nothing. Furthermore, and now I'm getting even more sketchy, if you choose the representation to be SL2, sorry, the group to be SL2 and its representation to be the standard two-dimensional representation, you'll get the Jones, well, you'll get an invariant which is equivalent to the Jones polynomial. If you choose SLN, you'll get something equivalent to the so-called Homflicht polynomial, named after Hoste, Okniano, Millet, Freid, Likorisch, Yetter, Pshetitsky, this fellow, and Tracik, okay, who all discovered it at the same time. If you take SON, you'll get the so-called Kaufmann polynomial, and there are a few other examples as well. Okay. Where does it come from? And again, I'm getting more and more sketchy because, well, you know, it's a finite amount of time. So it all comes from Witten and Feynman. So Witten wrote a certain quantum field theory, a certain path integral, which was supposed to compute knot invariants. And it's this horrible mess. So you integrate over the space of all Lie algebra valued 1 forms called A, the holonomy along the knot of A times the exponential of the so-called Chern-Simons form of A. That's a quantum field theory, and years before, it's a path integral over an infinite dimensional space, and that's what physicists call a quantum field theory, or, you know, this is a small chunk of, or it's related to quantum field theories at least. And Feynman, years before, figured out a way how to formally compute such integrals, and the way such integrals are computed is by a so-called the Feynman diagram prescription, in which a certain perturbative expansion of this integral is written as a sum of Feynman diagrams D. For each diagram, there is a certain Lie theoretic weight that comes from all the Lie algebras that occur in this expression, times a certain sum integral. Sum integral meaning you sum over discrete parameters and integrate over continuous parameters of a certain horrible integrand that is constructed out of the diagram. Okay? Now, what's that horrible integrand in the specific case of Chern-Simons theory? Well, in the specific case of Chern-Simons theory, the horrible integrand is horrible, but you manipulate it, manipulate it, and manipulate it, and at the end, it becomes the following thing. Remember this map here. I mean, I have one such map for each diagram. Okay? Take the volume form on this space. So this space has a volume, it's just a two-dimensional volume form of S2, wedge itself, wedge itself. Pull it back to this space and integrate it over here. Okay? But if you've seen degree computations, integrals of pullbacks of volume forms is the same as computing degrees, is the same as counting pre-images. So, again, with many details skipped, because the manifolds involved have boundaries, there are singularities, there are lots of things to worry about, but the basic point is that this sum of Feynman diagrams of such integrals becomes exactly the cosmic counting that I told you about before. So that cosmic counting was really an instance of, was really a story from quantum field theory. Okay. Good. Now, does it have any topological meaning? Sorry, I know, this part is sketchy. Are you with me? Are you, is it okay? I hope I'm not too sketchy. So, there's a lovely definition due to Vasiliev and Gusarov of a finite type invariant of knots. So a finite type invariant is like a polynomial on the space of knots. So it's not an invariant of knots whose values in polynomials. That would be, for example, the Jones polynomial. But rather, it's like a function on the space of knots, which as a function of the knot is a polynomial. Now, on Rn, or except it's polynomials converted to combinatorics somehow. So what would be a polynomial on Rn? It's something whose n, so a polynomial of degree n, is something whose n plus first, all of whose n plus first derivatives vanish. So if you differentiate it n plus 1 times, no matter in which direction, so for all choices of directions, now again I find the chopsticks useful, you get zero. But what's the derivative of a function? It's the difference of its value here minus its value here. What's a second derivative? Well, you take that difference, and you take the difference of these differences between here and here. But what it amounts to is to say that you're taking the value here, which is sort of when you complete the parallelogram, plus the value here, minus here, minus here. So derivatives are a bit like iterated differences. So borrow this idea and put it in knot theory and consider iterated differences of knots. Meaning, take a typical knot and mark 4 of its crossings. Well, 4 is an arbitrary number. It could have been 8. Okay? Well, not for this knot. Okay? And then, for each of these crossings, consider two alternatives. You either put in sort of an over or an under. And take these alternatives with opposite signs, and look at the 16 knots that are obtained in this way. So you get 16 possibilities of filling this purple disk with one of the two choices. So you get 16 knots. Each one comes with a sign, namely, sort of depending which choice, just multiply the signs corresponding to the to the choices. So you get 16 knots with signs. Take your invariant, evaluate it on all 16 knots, multiply by the corresponding signs and sum. That's like taking a fourth order derivative of that invariant. An invariant is of type 3 if it vanishes on all iterated differences with 4 such iterations. So these are finite type invariants. And an old theorem is that, well, the Jones polynomial is also a polynomial in this sense. Or more precisely, if you take, you look at each coefficient of the Jones polynomial, the Jones polynomial as a whole is not finite type. But if you look at each individual coefficient of the Jones polynomial, then, so the Jones polynomial is a polynomial in some variable x, at least after some change of variables, it's a polynomial in some variable x. If you look at the coefficient of x to the 7, that will be a finite type invariant of type 7. So this theory of finite type invariants is non-empty, and it's, well, it contains a lot of the classical knot theory, the Jones polynomial, Alexander polynomial, and so on. Then there is a conjecture, which is sort of an analog of Taylor's theorem. I mean, if you could approximate any function by a polynomial, then your functions would separate the points of the space. So basically, finite type invariants separate knots. It's a conjecture. We still don't know if it's true or not. And finally, there is a theorem that says that Z of K, the invariant I constructed at the beginning, is a so-called universal finite type invariant. So it contains all finite type invariants in it, and nothing but and if you know all the finite type invariants, you could reconstruct Z of K. Though, I mean, the definition of a universal finite type invariant is a bit more specific. I mean, it describes how it contains and how you can reconstruct it, but I don't want to give you the details. Maybe I'll just indicate why there is a sort of smell of finite typeness in the construction of Z. Why does it look like it's finite type? Okay? And again, the details will come later. And the reason is the following. So suppose I'm doing the cosmic count corresponding to all 16 knots that will occur when I do this alternation corresponding to this picture. Okay? If I have a chopstick beginning here, it will occur in all 16 variants and in exactly the same way. I mean, if I have a cosmic count in which there is a chopstick that starts here. Okay? So, and since I'm taking things with opposite signs, with alternating signs, such a thing will not contribute. So if I want to get a contribution to the cosmic, to the alternating sum of cosmic counts of all the invariant of all the knots that occur here, I must be placing chopsticks where the action happens. So I must have at least one chopstick starting here, and at least one chopstick starting here, and another one there, and another one there. And in fact, I could be a bit more refined than that, but I don't want to do that. But the point is that if I'm alternating over many, many places, I must have many, many chopsticks. So if I restrict my attention to the low complexity part of Z, it will vanish if I alternate sufficiently many times. So it will be kind of polynomial. Okay? You know, in words, if you want to dance in many parties, you must have many legs. I don't know. Are you still with me? Okay. Here's a fun statement. So knots are the wrong objects to study in knot theory. So it's like studying cakes in cooking. Okay, I mean, if you really do cooking, you should be first studying the basic ingredients. You know, flour and what do you make cakes of? Sugar, and then more sugar, I don't know. Anyway, but you should be studying the basic ingredients. And really what I mean by that is the following. So in no sense are knots a nice algebraic structure. There are no interesting algebraic operations on knots. And even if they were, actually there are a few. There is the connected sum of knots, okay? But under these operations, the space of all knots is not finitely generated or finitely presented or anything like that.
Okay?
And furthermore, with the operations that you have on knots, there are no interesting subclasses of knots that you can describe. So it's sort of a uniform, from the perspective of algebra, knots are just sort of uniform collection of undistinguishable objects. I don't know. Okay? However, not so for knotted trivalent graphs. So a knotted trivalent graph is, well, here are a few pictures. I think the pictures explain what the notion is. And the point about knotted trivalent graphs is that there are interesting operations among knotted trivalent graphs. So one operation is, so you know, if this is a piece of a knotted trivalent graph, so in fact these edges could be knotted, I'm just not showing their knottedness, there is an operation called delete, you could delete this edge, and there is another fun operation called unzip, which is to unzip this edge. Well, unzip meaning, think you have a zipper in the middle of the edge and you kind of unzip it. So the two parts fall apart, the two sides fall apart. Then there is also a binary operation. If you have two knotted trivalent graphs and they could be knotted, then you could sort of embed each one in a separate piece of space and add an edge to connect them. And it's sort of a fun exercise to see that this is well defined. Furthermore, the invariant I described previously, with work, extends to such creatures. So, instead of counting cosmic coincidences around a knot, I could be counting cosmic coincidences on top of a knotted trivalent graph. Okay? And I will have to reanalyze the catastrophes. There will be a new type of catastrophe, the so-called vertex invariance relation, but basically the story remains. The good thing about knotted trivalent graphs, and I'm not explaining anything because, how much time do I have? Is it 50 minutes or an hour?
No, it was 1 hour.
Oh, it was 1 hour. Okay, so I still have 3 minutes. I'm on schedule. So, but I will not give you the details. I will only tell you that knotted trivalent graphs with the operations I've indicated do form a finitely presented creature. In fact, they are all generated by the unknotted tetrahedron and by essentially the Möbius band. So kind of a circle with one sort of twist in it. Okay? And then there are relations, and this is a typical relation. So using, you could glue 3 tetrahedra together to form a triangular prism, but you could also glue 2 tetrahedra together to form a triangular prism. And a theorem which I completely cannot justify, but let me say that a Z, which so an invariant Z with valued in chopstick diagrams modulo relations, which is well behaved under all those operations, so homomorphic under all those operations on knotted trivalent graphs, well, to define such an invariant, you only need to define its value on the tetrahedron and the other generator, and they have to solve certain equations, like this equation. Now, these equations can get mapped via the sort of function into Lie algebras to equations about Lie algebras. And the equations you get are the so-called equations for a Drinfeld associator. No time to introduce what that is, but you know, it sits under high algebra. Okay, at least relatively high algebra. And now I'm done with the two halves of my talk, and I still have 30 seconds for the remainder. So I will tell you that what we mostly talk about today was counting, was cosmic coincidences and configuration space integrals for the case of ordinary, usual knots. But, and we talked with less detail about topology, combinatorics, low algebra, the relationship with Lie algebras, and high algebra, the relationship with the Drinfeld theory of associators. And what I will not at all say is that there is also a theory of V-knots and W-knots, so in particular W-knots are two-dimensional knotted objects living in four-dimensional space. And they have a corresponding low algebra, topology, combinatorics, low algebra, and high algebra, which is slightly different. Furthermore, what should I have said? I don't know. Furthermore, there are maps between three dimensions and four dimensions, and this corresponds to maps between the corresponding algebraic notions. Furthermore, there are lots of blocks in this rectangular kind of grid in which I have no clue what is going on. So there is a lot of work to do, and this is the work that I am here to do with the people who invited me. So Paolo, Emmanuel, Benjamin, I don't see him here, and JD. So that's the workshop that got me here. So thank you very much.
So there is any question?
It's okay.
It's okay.
No questions. Excellent.
Okay, thank you once more.